Ziegler was the Richard Perry University Professor of Anthropology and Family and Community Medicine here at UPenn. Over the last 30 years, his work has spanned a variety of urgent social problems. In Central America, he studied popular resistance, ethnicity, immigration, labor relations, and the social dislocation of street children. His work in the urban United States has examined inner city social suffering, gender power relations, substance abuse, violence, homelessness, and HIV prevention. His books include In Search of Respect, Selling Crack in Alvaria, and Ethnicity at Work, Divided Labor on a Central American Banana Plantation. For the past several years, he's been studying drug economies in Kensington. Professor Bourgeois studied at Harvard, Stanford, and the École Normale Supérieure in Paris. He's taught at UCSF, San Francisco State, and Washington University in St. Louis. He's a recipient of numerous awards and NIH grants, and his courses include students from multiple disciplines, including anthropology, medicine, nursing, public health, sociology, history, and social policy. Professor Bourgeois' talk today will focus on one of his most recent works, Righteous Dope Fiend, which chronicles the lives of homeless heroin addicts in San Francisco. Please give a warm welcome to Professor Bourgeois.
And it's always a pleasure for me to talk to medical students. I don't do it that much here at Penn, but where I used to, which is where most of the material I'll be talking about today is set in the General Hospital in San Francisco, which the medical school that I was at, UCSF, it was responsible for the residency program and so forth. So basically, I made a somewhat pedantic new title for a talk I used to give in San Francisco, and the title tries to give you in a second the essence of what I'm going to try to talk about to a certain extent. Frequent flyers, if you haven't done clinical rotations yet, frequent flyers are the people that irritate everyone in the emergency room because they come through regularly in absolutely terrible condition. They literally on the verge of dying, you know, often every couple of months or a couple of weeks, and so forth. And that's who I'm going to be talking about. A disproportional number of them are homeless heroin injectors and or, you know, crack smokers and alcoholics, usually all three. What I want to talk about specifically is how this stuff that I'll be presenting, which is really quite hideous sort of stuff when you look at it in terms of the individual actors who are involved in it, you need to step back from it and understand the structures that make this predictable and that will allow you as clinicians not to get sucked into getting burned out, angry, and frustrated and depressed at having your patients treat you badly and also die on you regularly and not follow your orders, so to speak. Let's see. What did I do? Oh yeah, here it is. So the material that I'm drawing from is actually almost all of it is in a book that came out a year and a half ago called Righteous Dope Fiend. I wasn't planning on doing this, but you get bored when you teach and so forth. And so what I really wanted to talk about, I just haven't figured out yet the clinical relevance of it to translate it into something to people that are, that are about to jump into your, I guess if a lot of people are second year or first year, you know, that will be jumping into clinical practice, which is the most exciting part of medical school. You know, you're going in the horrible part now if you're still in the coursework part. I won't go on in this, but this is what I'm working on here in Philadelphia using the same methodology. And we really live, I just wanted to let you know, we live in an extraordinary city for studying structural vulnerability, structural violence, the diseases of poverty, the diseases of civilization. We might actually live in the best city in the United States to understand it, because tragically, we're the poorest city in the United States. That's over a million people. So we have a substantial population and an interesting population with immigrant flows, and we represent the dynamics in structural terms of the forces that are less clear in other cities. And we've lost population every single year since 1950. Last year we stayed stable, but only because of the worst reason why you would stay stable, because basically we had a disproportional number of very poor people having babies, whereas we lost people to immigration, which is like the worst thing you want to do, right, in terms of your objective population, health and future, cultural capital and symbolic capital and so forth. So you have huge stretches of Philadelphia, especially in North Philadelphia, that are just wastelands that most of you probably won't ever see, but you can see them. I advise you to take the train to Somerset Station on the Market Frankfurt line and just walk around. You don't have to stay a long time. Just walk around for 10 minutes and it will absolutely blow your mind. You won't be able to believe what you see. And it's definitely, I think it's a life-changing thing for people to do that. Just take a half hour. It takes you 20 minutes to get out there from 34th Street. Take a half hour, come right back. You can do the whole thing in an hour and a half. And I promise you won't think the same. And you'll understand much better many of the patients that you probably will be seeing, especially when you rotate through the ICU, by seeing them on the outside. And you just have miles and miles and miles and miles of this kind of view in Philadelphia. You do see it in West Philadelphia, but it's nothing compared to what you see in North Philadelphia. Basically the only white people who see it, not the only white people, but almost the only white people who see it are extraordinarily poor and or addicted to drugs. And it's just the form, and I'll tell you why. You see it, this is just the statistics of ethnic segregation in our city. We live in one of the most ethnically, racially, it gets racialized, because that's the way ethnicity works in the United States. Cities in the United States, the demographers call it hypersegregation. They can't even call it segregation. They have to call it hypersegregation. And what you see here is, this is the neighborhood that I'm studying now in North Philadelphia, which is the Puerto Rican neighborhood. And it's wedged between between African American and white sections of Philadelphia. So in this picture, the black sections are African American and the white sections are white. And in this picture, the green sections are white and the white sections are, am I doing this right? The green sections are white and the white sections are African American. So you can see how, and one of the tragedies that I won't be able to get in today, but I did a talk once a couple years ago here when there was a prison interest group, because I think health really can intervene on these questions better than any other sort of scientific institutional entity in our country. But you see that the grotesqueness of this turning African American, right? This is where the prison complex is in Philadelphia, one of the biggest, largest urban prison complexes in America. LA has a bigger one, but in New York City with Rikers Island has a bigger one, and that's it. I'll show you a picture of it. And this is the field work. It's actually incredibly fun to do field work. I can't sort of believe that they pay me in the summer to hang out in fire hydrants with super friendly people sometimes and actually learn stuff from it. These are the methods that we use in anthropology. They aren't methods that most of you have probably been exposed to, because they basically only exist as the core of the discipline in anthropology. Other disciplines draw on them, sociology especially, and a few others, some little tiny corner of political science and geography and so forth. But basically, I tried to translate it into your language. I'm not from a medical background. I was chair of a social medicine department, so I'm familiar with your frameworks and so forth. But I wanted to try to explain it to you. Folks in my discipline wouldn't even recognize this language, because we live in different epistemological worlds from what you guys call evidence-based medicine, which doesn't make sense to us, because evidence for us is both statistical and qualitative. That you, in fact, only having statistical evidence for us would be putting sort of irrational blinders on yourself and refusing to take advantage of how it's possible to understand the world around you. But anyhow, so this is basically what we try to do. You develop organic relationships with people and try to understand their logic. The specific project that I'm doing is in trying to understand the phenomenon of addiction and ill health in Philadelphia. Is sort of summarizing this photograph, basically, the easy part of the argument. We are one of the most deindustrialized cities in the United States. Actually, we deindustrialized in a different way from cities like Detroit because we had a really good diversified industry. So it happened in a very torturous long-term process that confused people. People didn't just rush out of Philadelphia. They trickled out because we made the machines that other factories use, which are the last ones to be deindustrialized, essentially. We also had, you know, large clothing, stuff like that. But you can keep clothing around for very rich people because their styles change a lot. So that didn't leave us until transportation got much better and digital communication for style and so forth. But so basically what's happened is we lost, and I'm sorry, I forgot the statistic. We lost our jobs, and they were reasonably good jobs. A lot of them were unionized jobs. Philadelphia is a union town. And now folks living in the industrial sections of Philadelphia who used to be able to literally roll out of bed and find a job, rickety split, at any one of the factories all around them, now are basically finding themselves forced to sell drugs in the shadows of the factories that used to employ their parents, essentially. And it's become this extraordinary cheap and very open-air drug market that grotesquely is primarily serviced by African Americans and Puerto Ricans and primarily fueled by whites. I mean, it's a mind-boggling thing. This is why I want you to go to Somerset Station, because it's hard for you to believe me saying this. You might think I'm an ultra-leftist kook or something like that. But it's really extraordinary. Most of the addicts are white, and virtually all of the sellers, except right at Somerset Station, and that's just because the police don't arrest people that much there. But if you walk two blocks away from Somerset Station, you'll see this ethnic apartheid very, very, very clearly. And it's really a tragedy, because what it does essentially is it condemns, and this isn't clinically relevant, I'm sorry, but it's just too exciting to you. What it does, tragically, is it condemns kids who were born in this neighborhood to go to prison. And this entire neighborhood has become basically a nursery for fueling the prison system. And Philadelphia did have the highest, this is a mind-boggling statistic, the highest per capita incarceration rate of any, county jail incarceration rate, of any city in the United States. Not just the 1 million largest city. This was in 2006 that we got that dubious distinction. The Pew Foundation put out a report on it. It fluctuates every now and then, but we're always at the very, very, very top. Or close to the top. And these are the folks that will be ending up in prison or will be getting killed, who I make friends with and hang out with and get condemned to lives of violence and suffering, essentially, and early death, mostly. If you go to the local, these things are really easy to get in terms of evidence-based statistics. If you go to the local cemetery, look through the ages, every single age here will be under 23 years old. And this isn't, we didn't do a systematic, look through and take a picture of everything. This is just in a 5-minute walk through the local cemetery, you'll find stuff like this. And you'll see all these weeping mothers after, it's really, I don't even want to talk about it too much because my mother died recently. But, it's really, really upsetting if you get there on a day when there's funerals, people shrieking and weeping and so forth. It's just ridiculous amounts of early death and suffering that get produced by this neighborhood, essentially. This is the other side of the coin where people end up. This is our prison complex. It's an extraordinarily large site. This probably was the original building done as a panopticon. And every single one of these is the massive expansion of prisons that's taken place in the last 50 years. When you look at the statistics, actually, I should have reversed these slides. When you look at the statistics, this is a slide I meant to do at first. I mean, this is the wonderful thing about evidence-based medicine or whatever, you know, evidence-based research, is things become very, very, very clear when you see the numbers, when they work in some sense, and when they're not ambiguous. This is what's happened in the United States that you're completely sort of unaware of. You might know about it rationally, but you cannot imagine that when Ronald Reagan took over in 1980, this kind of a disaster was going to happen in terms of investment of resources. This is the number of people in jail, historically, from 1920 to 2006. I mean, it is really, really weird what we've done in this country, and we're completely oblivious to it. You know, we know there's been a rise in the prison, but we have no idea that we've gone completely haywire in locking up our population. And these are just, you know, boring statistics. There's nothing to interpret with them in some sense. I'll just add them up. Okay, so now I want to then go into what I am going to talk about, which is completely clinically relevant. It's actually slightly less relevant to Philadelphia in some of the technical stuff. And if someone at a later date, once you've gone through some clinical rotations and seen homeless heroin injectors and crack smokers and alcoholics, if you give me feedback, I'd appreciate it to know more about how the sort of ill health of homeless addicts and street-based drug users manifests itself in the emergency rooms and in the, you know, intensive care units and of the hospital. So this was everything is pseudo-multicultural in San Francisco. This was the group of homeless heroin addicts that I was studying, and this is the methods, of course, where you actually have to do things like sleep in your encampment and so forth in order to understand what's you know, really going on. And I just wanted to give you. I know from teaching in the medical school, they used to make us make these slides, and this was the slide. After you see this, you could leave and pass the exam and so forth. People would do that, you know, right? I hated teaching in medical school. So this is a really, really, really simple concept that I wanted to teach you, and it's extraordinarily useful for clinical practice. It's probably the most useful thing you can learn, I think, from social medicine, and a lot of good clinicians learn it and then manipulate it basically in order to have complete and total power. That's the Arthur Kleinman model, to have complete and total power over your patients. Because once you understand that they are coming from a place that is completely rational within their own framework, you can then manipulate their framework. I mean, that's for the sociopathic power hunger, or just the people that want to save their patients from dying, basically. You just have to understand this. So you don't have to be a gross person to manipulate them, but that's the reality of it. And this is it, right? No culture is good or bad, all have a logic. So culture is just this large word that's kind of meaningless, but in this case it means, you know, no set of people that you're able to identify, like homeless heroin addicts and crack smokers, who have certain commonalities among each other, are you know, good or bad. They exist in their own world that has a logic that makes them do the acts that they do. And these are just a few of the solution. There's a great article that I think is the most useful. It's by the author. I actually hired her at UCSF, but I'll email it to Luke. But the crucial thing to understand is that what they might try to teach you cultural competence, right? And they do it all wrong in the medical school. It's not their fault. They're trying to do it fast and efficiently, right? So they're trying to give you a checklist that says, you know, with Asians, be careful, they won't manifest their depression and they're ashamed of it or something like that. You know, with, you know, Hispanics, touch them a lot and they have a very limited sense of space. And, you know, African American women don't get hot flashes or do get hot, you know, whatever the technical types of things. And they used to, check this out. I had a colleague in the social medicine department who actually made a little book that could be put in a white coat and fit in it narrowly, that was long, that was exactly that laundry list, if you can believe it. It was published and, you know, they made lots of money distributing it to medical students and so forth. So that's the opposite. I mean, that's actually can be useful in some ways, but it can also then just be the caricature of itself and turn into the very racism that it's trying to combat and turn into the miscommunication that it's trying to combat. And the only way to get it, so to speak, is to recognize that you're an outsider to whatever the logic is of that culture that you're not understanding, of that self-destructive behavior that isn't making sense to you, of that angry behavior that, you know, of someone killing them, from your perspective, killing themselves, and being, you know, like someone that's really unpleasant, who smells bad, or whatever it is in terms of what you're going to be seeing in the emergency rooms. It was actually more fun to teach at UCSF because we ran the general hospital, so everyone saw a lot of these patients. Philadelphia destroyed its health system by closing down its general hospitals. And general hospitals, if you're committed to serving the underpoor, they're the place to go because they attract people who are committed to serving the underpoor. So all of a sudden, you're surrounded by all these progressive doctors who actually want to help poor people and like poor people, unlike most doctors who, you know, might like poor people in a theoretical way, but they are hard to deal with when you're rich, and they're hard to deal with when you're operating in a different world. So it's just recognizing that you don't understand it, and that there is a way to understand it, and that you're like a little kid and need to find out about it, to be socialized into understanding your logic. Okay, so, you know, this is more in your language. You can think of it as competing priorities that lead to contradictory healthy and unhealthy outcomes. And then this is the radical political part that I can't escape wanting to make sure that you understand, because it's also analytical, is that if you can understand structural forces, you can get less angry at being a failed clinician in terms of the proportion of your patients who do badly, you know, just sort of in objective terms. So this is, you know, in somewhat simpler language, transcending cultural miscommunication and, you know, getting at the logic of self-abuse and making cultural relativism just a common sense that you can draw on as a toolkit when you're a clinician. So now what I'm going to do now, I'll start reading to make it more efficient. And then, Luke, if you could tell me, I can see the clock, but I probably won't know. Tell me when we have 15 minutes left and so forth, because I'm on page one. So this is who we're calling Hank, Jeff and I, the person who co-authored Righteous Dope Fiend with me, who's actually a student of mine right now, getting a PhD in anthropology. But at the time was a photographer, ethnographer. So I'll be presenting them this case study of two homeless objectors, Hank and Petey, who are what is called running partners on the street, and document their interaction with medical care. This is excerpted then from 12 years of fieldwork notes, because one has to sort of be obsessive to do this right and collect enough data and then, you know, use those horrible programs like Atlas TI software coding to try to get the best of your material and then be able to present it. And I'll read from my very first fieldwork note when I first met Hank in November of 1994. Hank, an old-timer in his mid-50s, sleeps in a bright red pup tent, having just been thrown out of a project apartment in the neighborhood up the hill, where he has been staying for the past year. He has a bad stab wound under his right armpit from a pimp who, he says, is jealous of his dealings with one of his prostitutes. Felix, another one of the homeless heroin injectors in our scene, dismisses Hank's bloody gash as being, quote, probably just an abscess that got cut out of him at the county hospital. Don't ever believe a word that Hank says to you. Once we got used to Hank's slurred way of speaking and the way he shaked and bobbed uncontrollably when he was high or drank too much, we actually grew close to him and realized that he was fun, actually kind of a, could be a fun person to hang out with, and was actually quite intelligent. He actually hustled us less for money than many of the other folks that we befriended in the scene, and that's part of the nature of addiction, is that you know, your priority is getting money for your next use, so you have to hustle all your friends and your family, and you have to rip off everyone around you, because otherwise you're throwing up all over the place, or you're depressed, or you're anxious, and so forth. Okay, so what he did as a sort of identity strategy was seek out the modicum of dignity that you can get as a homeless drug addict or a homeless alcoholic, of masculine dignity especially, for white middle-aged homeless heroin addicts, and that is the identity of having PTSD because of Vietnam, and that's something that gets forgiven, that sort of gets forgiven to people, and they actually get much better medical treatment. The VAs are fantastic for the poor, and they have better outcomes, you know, in statistical-based medicine than any other institutions in the country. It's pretty extraordinary. And especially for African American veterans who have even less access to being treated decently by institutions. So he interrupted his detailed gory stories about Vietnam with bouts of sobbing and shaking, sometimes even ducking for cover when cars backfired. I'm embarrassed to say we tape recorded several hours of his Vietnam firefight stories until his sister, we actually knew it before. Until we obtained his medical records and discovered that he hadn't been to Vietnam. And then we met his sister, and she was also a homeless heroin addict. And when she explained this, when Hank turned 18, he was classified, quote, 4F, unfit for military duty. He didn't want to go in the army. He fixed, that means he injected, into both his hands right before going in for the interview. And they looked like balloons. So as you can see, Hank was actually smart. He didn't want to get killed. He wasn't going to do this, but he was already a heroin user at that time. Now, arguably, however, and this took us some time to be able to resurrect him after feeling like morons for believing his Vietnam story for so long, because people are just extraordinarily persuasive about it, and half the time it's true, or maybe a quarter of the time it's true, and three quarters of the time it isn't. But you don't have to worry about that, because they probably do suffer from what psychiatrists would diagnose as PTSD, just not from Vietnam. In Frank's case, and his sister explained this to us, our father was French Polynesian from Papeete and worked in the shipyards, but he would get drinking and start getting crazy, beat up the house, beat on my mother. Did Hank tell you about that? Hank would jump on our dad's back, just like a little puppy dog, up there on his back, laughing nervously. Dad, leave mom alone. It's terrible. My mother just died a few weeks ago, and I can't even do these talks yet, because you have to give time for mourning and so forth. And Hank tried to protect me too when I got beat up. Well, I'll just skip that one, just because it's sad. It ends with, all of us got hooked up on drugs. 35 years or so later, at age 50, Hank avoided contact with the county hospital emergency room by lancing his own abscesses. It was a grotesque process to watch, and we misinterpreted it at first as self-mutilation related to his traumatically violent childhood, the childhood of having an abusive alcoholic father who used to beat him and his sister and his mother savagely. Sorry about this picture, but otherwise people think that we're making up our stories or exaggerating them. But basically, he executes what's called in medical parlance an incision and drain on an abscess and then remove with in this case scissors, but in other cases he would use a piece of a tin can that he would break, because they're nice and sharp and cut cleanly. And then he would pull out all the junk from it. Now, after covering the site with ointment and some sterile packed bandages left by a visiting nurse from a pilot health outreach project for the homeless, San Francisco is just full of those progressive pilot projects that actually work. The trouble is they don't get institutionalized permanently, but they work like magic, when they do them, and then they just waste more NIH funding developing another one to make them even better, and then institutions don't institutionalize them. But that was a health project for the homeless. You'd never ever see bandages that beautiful on the street normally. And Hank lifts a full syringe of heroin and plunges it almost up to its hilt into the side of the freshly bandaged abscess. And what it took us a while, and this wasn't, it was the only reason I learned this, is because I collaborate with clinicians. I like clinicians because they have this kind of practical, technical knowledge. A clinician said, hey, stop, Philippe, forget about this, your weird sort of ethical, moralistic confusion about is he self-destructive, is he this or that. This is medically an incredibly smart place to inject if your priority is to get high. Because an abscess basically it's dead material, but it's on the edges of it, especially there's ton, it's very vascular, right? The blood is rushing to it to try to cure it, to try to heal it. And so you get the same effect as, almost the same effect as injecting into a vein directly. And then on top of it, it doesn't even hurt because the material's dead, right? And are almost dead. And so it's actually a very, very smart place when you have that priority. Now, your other option to get that that level of pleasure. Actually, your only option if you're into speedballs and Sonny, to his disaster, his favorite high was to mix cocaine and heroin together. Right? That's actually super successful people on the street. That tends to be what they're into because it's very hard to do and it's lots of fun. And it's actually very smart. The folks that analyze brains say that there's a production of dopamine level that's more than the sum of the parts because of some weird interaction, which they don't yet understand, of how the synapses work. And it's not even the synapse level; it's happening at a closer to protein level, right? For releasing extraordinary waves of pleasure. And so the trouble, of course, with cocaine is that you can't absorb it efficiently unless it's a direct blood deposit. Otherwise, it just burns the tissue, and you don't even feel the effect of it. Right? So where he's injecting is there, and you can go, ugh, what a horrible place to inject. Blah, blah, blah. But the fact of the matter is, if you're primarily worried about being sure to get your speedball high, and secondarily worried about getting arrested by the police, which are the two most likely statistical problems that you're going to have, right, given your priorities, this is the fastest place that you can find an easy to find, an easy to administer injection that will get it right into your bloodstream. The statistical outcome for the kind of filth that you've been seeing in the pictures and the filthy conditions are abscesses, are soft tissue infections. At the San Francisco General, this is really a mind-boggling statistic. The primary inpatient procedure up until 2000 was just a simple abscess treatment, simple boring abscess treatment. That actually is very easy to do, responds very well to medical treatment, and gets cured in some sense. And it was expensive as well, obviously. You have less of that here because you don't have the same kind of heroin. In Philadelphia, we have heroin that primarily comes from Colombia, and they process their heroin differently. All the heroin almost all the heroin west of the Mississippi River is Mexican black tar. And Mexican black tar is vulnerable to it's more caustic. It burns your veins. You lose your veins more rapidly. You start muscling very soon after you're physically addicted, or you find yourself shooting into your neck and missing veins and getting abscesses from missed veins. So you'll see fewer abscesses, and this is where I'd eventually want to adapt this so that it's a lecture that's more directly relevant to you. I've started hanging out more now directly in the shooting galleries in North Philadelphia. You can go hang out in one really easily. All you have to do is walk down the railroad tracks. That whole railroad track is one immense shooting gallery, an open air one. And you just ask anyone where the railroad tracks, especially if you're white, they'll just assume you're walking to the railroad tracks, because everyone will think you're an addict, by the way, if you're white. If you're not white, they won't even notice you. But it's really extraordinary. You're going to get stereotyped instantly. Everyone will offer you drugs. People won't even think you're a cop, even if you wear a suit and tie and stuff like that. They'll just think you're a white addict who wears a suit and tie. And they don't believe you. They won't believe you if you say you're a medical student or anything like that. They'll just think you're a good, hustling, friendly, sweet, good, that you have a good accent and so forth. White heroin addict. So what was happening then was that it turned out that this form of treatment they were using at the General was iatrogenic. They were doing a deep scraping and carving, and then releasing the users back out without prescriptions for painkiller. And this was because they thought that the best practices for addicts is not to give them opiate-based painkillers. And this is an extraordinary thing. You might have actually heard this already in lectures. It's just that's absolutely false. When you have that kind of a gouge, if you're not given an opiate-based painkiller, you are going to suffer more than anyone can imagine what physical suffering is. This guy could not deal with the wind with that open gash. Someone like that with a gash, has to have painkillers unless you want to purposefully torture them and so forth. So don't believe your doctors when they say that you shouldn't prescribe opiates to addicts. But it is problematic for people at different stages of their addiction, especially recovered addicts and so forth. But that's something that you have to figure out in your artisanal practice with someone. And it's not, there's no clear answer to that, right? Tragically, opiate pills have become the major form of entry into addiction now. At this moment in our history, and it's rather an extraordinary thing the way especially Percocet gets diverted. If you're allowed to prescribe Dilaudid, prescribe that. That's the absolute best one and causes the least abscesses and doesn't damage your liver. The absolutely idiotic thing is that Percocets are mixed with Tylenol so that people take these large quantities and then the Tylenol destroys the liver. It's completely insane, and the company is just making too much money off of it to take the Tylenol out. There is a slight positive effect from the Tylenol combining with the opiates to boost the effect of the opiate, but it's just not worth the level of damage that the Tylenol causes to the liver. That's a little clinical aside. I don't do clinical stuff, but it's weird that clinical logics aren't even followed by clinical medicine in some sense. There's no ambiguity about that Percocet problem. You can prescribe clean pills that are super cheap that stop pain. Pain is one of the great things that we have. We have good technological stuff for pain. Okay, so what we were seeing was these grotesque, absolutely unnecessary, grotesque ways of treating abscesses. And what the surgeons thought they were doing was they thought they were protecting people from necrotizing fasciitis. And then we showed them that statistically, the most people that have ever died of necrotizing fasciitis in San Francisco, and this is a year when there were 4,000 abscesses, were, you can't even guess how many, 12 people. That's like the highest number that ever died. So because 12 people died of necrotizing fasciitis, they did 4,000 surgeries like this, completely unnecessary. That could have been just a simple incision and drain, just the way you saw Hank doing it with a pair of scissors. Abscesses are super, super easy to treat. But the thing that was extraordinary about this, we basically made an alliance with surgeons, and those of you, you'll be discovering this in your clinical practice if it isn't already common sense to you. Surgeons are hard to deal with. You know, they're smart and so forth, but they're, you know, super, super, super alpha. You can tell how they walk down the hall controlling everything. And they're not scientific. You know, they don't read, they're not intellectuals. They're basically, you know, extraordinarily, if they're good, they're extraordinarily skilled artisans. And usually they're pretty greedy and refuse to publish or don't have the mental capacity or interest to publish. Because what you want as a surgeon to get rich is to develop an unreproducible artisanal skill that people travel, that especially sheiks from the Middle East travel to come to and pay huge sums to be treated by them. And that's where I would go, you know, if I could afford it and so forth. It really, that strategy, and most of them are actually conscious of that strategy. When you talk to them about it, push them a little bit. A lot of them aren't, of course, and most of them aren't that good either, because they, you know, when they do those double-blind, evidence-based things, you know, those knee surgeries are useless, right? Even back surgery, most back surgeries as well, 50%, you know, when they do random control, double-blind, deaf and dumb studies, they find that people, you know, recover in roughly equivalent proportions with a lot of the surgeries that we take for granted being necessary surgeries. But when you're in pain, you just can't think through those thoughts. And it takes a long time to heal when you don't do the surgery. So I do want to go back and remind you that even though we're taking all these clinical errors seriously and so forth, the fact of the matter is, we need to be humble and remember that the primary problem faced by homeless addicts that's creating ill health isn't that clinicians are klutzy, you know, racist and culturally incompetent caregivers. It's simply that the war on drug completely overshadows medicine in our country. And you guys are basically doing a sideshow. It's a positive sideshow. You're providing lots of help to people in desperate shape. But the thing that's driving most of this stuff is people being thrown into jail. It is that curve that takes up, which then leads to, you know, just outrageously filthy and desperate types of practices that prevent, you know, a harm reduction approach to preventing to preventing the spread of soft tissue infections and to preventing, you know, HIV and so forth. But that's just an aside. But I did want to remind you about that. And let me, actually, I'm taking so long. Let's see where I am, because I wasn't reading it, which would have made it go faster. But I'm only on page 5. I'll just try to sum it up in 5 minutes, because I wanted to leave 10 minutes for questions. So basically, this is getting cleaned out of a homeless encampment. And what that does is it throws them, they lose everything that they have, right? He's leaving with all his possessions. You know, he's lost all his clean needles. He's lost all, you know, whatever, his clothes, his sleeping bag, everything just gets ground up by and carted away by garbage trucks and so forth. And then you see, what's amazing is after these police sweeps, you would see these extraordinary increases of risky practices, of direct sharing a dirty needle and so forth. They become just, you know, very clear-cut vectors for transmitting, you know, germs and viruses and so forth. So, this is basically how you prepare heroin. Once again, it's hard to believe, you know, the crushed bottom of a Coke can, but that's, if you go to the train tracks near Somerset, you'll see people preparing heroin this way. Although they do it differently, because our heroin doesn't need to be stirred. The heroin, it dissolves very easily in water, whereas the Mexican black tar is even filthier. That actually might be the reason, for that matter, for the necrotizing fasciitis. You have to pick something up and crush it a little bit to make sure all the heroin dissolves. And as soon as you do that, you're introducing a whole bunch of, you know, you could be introducing the fasciitis bacteria. So, what they find themselves doing is also sharing these small amounts, especially when they've run out of resources, and treating each other to tastes out of their own container of heroin, and they're doing that as a as a favor to one another. Of course, from our perspective, and this is the cultural relativism, from our perspective, sharing like that, sharing out of a little crushed can, each one of three of us taking, you know, a little portion into their syringe, becomes basically a vector for all that. In their logic, sharing guarantees you that they'll actually say that you'll stay well, that you'll stay healthy. Because if you have a reputation for being generous, if you have a reputation for anyone who comes to me and asks me for a taste, I'll give them a little taste, then you'll never find yourself in withdrawal symptoms. Because everyone, no matter how sort of, not everyone, but most people will be smart enough to know, if I share with this guy, he'll give me, he's a generous person, he's not very bright or whatever it is, he's gonna give me a dose later on when I need it. So people are in these moral economies of exchange, and you see, and so you want to develop a generous reputation, even though you also are simultaneously, you know, picking the pocket of the person that you just shared heroin with. You're trying to present a generous, and this prevents you from being so dope sick that you can no longer hustle, that you can no longer beg or steal or mug someone, to get your next dose of heroin. Whereas when someone gives you just a little taste, even a relatively small taste, it'll usually stave your heroin withdrawal symptoms for another hour or two, which will, you know, will give you a chance of having time to raise the amount of money to buy a $10 bag of heroin. So you see that regularly. Now I want to flip to Pete and Hank. They were running partners, as I said, and their health started to decay dramatically. And following that series of police sweeps, the whole scene started to become riskier and riskier in terms of places that you would take refuge in to inject. By the way, you look at this and you go, what kind of a maniac could inject in this area, in a place like this? This is actually a brilliant place to inject. If your priority is not to get arrested, do you think a police officer will walk into this shack? No way. This place stinks. There's water outside because it was raining. They would have to wet their shoes and so forth. This is actually a great place to hang out and inject and be guaranteed that you won't get arrested, so long as you just throw everything on the ground there. Because you can't be, you can in Philadelphia because we have a corrupt police force. But in San Francisco, where you don't have a very corrupt police force, you can't just be arrested arbitrarily for, you know, being around a shooting gallery. What was interesting with this also, this is Silicon Valley. So remember, this is the wealthiest zip code, one of the wealthiest zip codes in the United States. This is the heart of Silicon Valley. And this is what filters down to the homeless, right? The obsolete desktop monitors that flat screens replace. Or even just these, just obsolete computers. Hank started going to the emergency room complaining of seizures. He would call them strokes. And he invented a very dramatic story about how the only other person with this disease was someone else who was in Maekwan, Delta Valley, at the same year that he was, and so forth. So we were sort of dismissing it and so forth, but it turned out we got our trusty clinician, who was a member of our ethnographic team, and we sent him to go visit Hank, and he did confirm that Hank, it took the hospital a long time to figure it out, that Hank had an infection of his spinal cord system that had gone up into his brain that was putting pressure on the brain and then giving him these seizures. And what would happen with the logic of the emergency room and cost-effective, not cost-effective, it's cost-ineffective, but with the budget cuts that were taking place at that time, the hospital, the utilization review committee of the hospital would put a note in any doctor's or any intern's file if they were keeping their patients in too long. So to get a good, letter of recommendation, whatever it is, everyone was throwing people out of the hospital as soon as possible. So Hank was responding very well to chemotherapy to control that infection, right? It's it's relatively easy, it's easy to treat, right, with good, strong antibiotics. But as soon as he could hobble up and walk again, they would send him out of the emergency room, and he'd be looking good. He'd be looking clean with clean clothes and so forth, right? The ICU was good to him in that sense. He really would recover fast. And then he would, you know, this is literally, that's what he got, right? He still had, they had to give him a cane to hobble out still, but he could hobble. So they threw him out of the hospital, and then within 6 weeks, his infection would rev up again because he wouldn't obviously finish his pills, you know, his antibiotic pills, and he would end back up in the emergency room. Then simultaneously, his partner, Petey, fell apart. His was a straightforward liver failure that put him in the ICU for 6 weeks. Now, if you can imagine how much 6 weeks in the ICU costs, and in the, you know, you can, I mean, livers are extraordinary things, right? They're super, super powerful organs, and they recover. And he actually recovered. He cycled in and out maybe 4 or 5 times before he recovered, and luckily he was a real veteran, so he qualified for one of those miraculous VA administration recovery things, and a job training program. And he has a job now as an orderly in the VA hospital, and is, you know, living happily ever after, which was completely incomprehensible to us. But I'm going to stop here because I did want to hear some of your questions and so forth, but there's a whole other set of stuff that I was going to talk about in terms of you know, some other you know, sort of quick fix magic solutions to these problems, which I can tell you super fast. But basically, they instituted a high utilizer program, where you can just computerize anyone that's been in more than, you know, X number of times within the last 6 months, gets a team of friendly doctors and social workers and nurses sicked on them, and they won't do that anymore. They won't be frequent flyers anymore. They just get showered with services. And they did a random controlled deaf and dumb blind thing with an NIH grant and so forth, and showed that actually, tragically, it didn't save money, it broke even, but the quality of the outcome was fantastic. You can find it in the Annals of Surgery or so forth. Two of those studies, actually. So that's actually what they've done now, and they've improved things. They also changed the way they treat abscesses, and it's now all done with incision and drain, and you never see that kind of carving that I showed you the pictures of. But let me just open it up for questions.
So you talked a lot about like ways in which the system fails these patients, and at the end just now you talked about like a way to improve it. But also, I'm trying to stay like culturally relativistic, but like how is the best way to approach like getting this population away from drugs and like back on their feet?
Well, different countries have different strategies. The one, with heroin addicts, there's one very, very easy way, right, where you can turn their lives around, and that's to prescribe them heroin. So that's what Switzerland does. And they have all these, you know, random double-blind, you know, deaf and dumb studies to show that people stop beating up their family, stop stealing from everyone around them, stop committing suicide, and stop being frequent flyers if they can come into a clinic and have a doctor prescribe pure heroin. You know, and they actually supervise the injection. You know, the Swiss do everything in like sort of hyper anal retentive ways, and they actually have nurses who stand out and order people to wash their hands before they inject when they come into the. It's an extraordinary thing to visit those safe injection sites and those heroin prescriptions. It's called diversified opiate prescription. So that works super well for heroin. It doesn't work as well, you know, for crack and cocaine, which you'll see a lot of, especially at the hospitals here, because of the surrounding population, more than heroin. It's a much more complicated thing, and we don't have a magic quick fix solution for cocaine. It's a much more disruptive drug. It actually damages your organs. Opiates don't damage your organs, right? If you get a clean supply of opiates, you can live forever. You can die of old age, right? And there's lots of doctors and anesthesiologists addicted to opium, and they have great, rich, wealthy careers and so forth, and they live happily or unhappily ever after. But in that sense, there's lots of those kinds of things that can improve the margins to some extent. But that happened to Hank by accident, because actually it was one of they had me as a attending anthropologist for the primary care person at the clinical case studies that the residents would present, and the residents would be told to bring in their cases complicated by substance use. And so one of the residents brought in Hank's case. I didn't know it, right? And she burst into tears, right, presenting Hank's case. This was at the time when he was cycling in with those embolisms to his, going into his brain from his spinal cord infection. I think it's called, not embolism, whatever it is, I just forget all the medical language. I used to, when I was doing this regularly, I would get the language right, because you lose all your credibility. I'm much more interested in social science theory than in sort of the technical plumbing of the body system, which is great, you have to know it. But some people think it's boring. Sorry about that, that was unnecessary. So she presented his case, right? And she was in tears, and he had refused. He had basically had a fight with her the last time, demanding a larger prescription of Percocets, right? And actually, in his case, she was actually giving him, I forget what she was giving him. I think it was a morphine pill of some kind. All I did was, because you can't say things too radically and so forth, especially to doctors, I just talked about what the Swiss would do with Hank and what the outcome would be. And they say, if you want Hank to come back from his chemotherapy, you have to meet his number one priority. His number one priority is not being dope sick. It's not going into heroin withdrawals. So if you promise to renew his prescription for opiate pills every time he comes in, you can make him come in every 3 days if you want to make him yo-yo back and forth and so forth. You can make him take, and he will cure his problem, because he will, when he gets a free supply of pure drugs, he will come to it and be happy with it in some sense. Not be happy, but at least be, not distracted by the physical pain of withdrawal symptoms. And so she did that, actually. And he recovered. She actually then did the next step. She was a genius doctor. She's now head at the General Hospital of that frequent flyer program. She was so good at dealing with homeless heroin addicts that they made her the person that coordinates all of the the impossible patients, basically, who are frequent flyers who come more than X number of times. She actually then took the next step. And the next steps are hard. They're not realistic steps for all doctors. You basically sort of have to be a saint to do it. She actually contacted the judge, you can't even trust the lawyers to get someone on SSI. The social workers are worthless as well. She actually went in person and got him his SSI case and won it for him. Doctors can do it like that. You're the only people that can do it, actually. And you have to have the power of a doctor to guarantee someone getting SSI. And Social Security insurance, right? And so, Hank was no problem. He had a bunch of fractured discs, an objective thing. So she could also, very relaxedly, legally prescribe him as much opiates as he needs. She had the documentation that this guy is, has objective pain in his back. So that's what she did, and had a great outcome with him. He then got housed, renting a room in someone's garage, and now fixes cars, because he happens to be very skilled at fixing cars. But anyhow, that's too long a question. I mean, too long an answer. And I wanted to hear more from you guys.
I have a question. When we hit the wards and we see these patients, and they're and they're probably going to be, you know, smelling bad and maybe trying to hustle us. I assume we're going to have like a visceral reaction when we see them. And so what would be your advice for, I guess, getting over that emotional reaction and being able to do what's in their best interest?
That's a great question. I just want to hear a few other questions as well, and then we can try to punch them.
I have to go in like 2 seconds, sorry. But I'm curious how you got informed consent to perform research on
Sure.
a vulnerable population.
Someone, how you got them to trust you?
I'm sort of curious about how you feel about the U.S.'s approach to heroin addicts with methadone. Do you think it's effective or better?
Okay.
So these are all awesome questions. Just want to make sure some folks have to head out too. So
okay. Okay, just super quickly. Methodologically, it's super easy. People want to be famous and they want to be important and so forth. And the only thing they're angry about is that I didn't use their real names. And I said, look, I'll get fired from my university. My IRB imposes that I have to change everyone's names. You know, the other thing is that the police don't really hassle folks like that. They're not literate enough at the local level to even know that I've ever done this book or anything like that. And that section of the police force that would read a book like this and might want to pursue someone isn't going to waste their time with these people, right? I mean, obviously, if I was studying high-level dealers, I wouldn't be able to, to reveal pictures and so forth, unless they were, had changed their lives or, there was a statute of limitations or so forth. And then in terms of what you were talking about, I think only the clinical practitioner can figure out on some level the answer to your question, because the simplest way is finding other people to discuss this with, because it's more or less guaranteed to happen to you, right? I mean, you'd have to be almost weird not to get confused by what you're seeing when you see non-adherence and so forth. And I think that the way to deal with it is to process it with people that are seeing the same thing. Methadone is a great thing. Methadone has problems, and especially the way it's done in the United States, it has problems. I have an article on this if you want to see the details of it in Culture, Medicine, and Psychiatry. Can do a Google search or whatever, and I think it's called Disciplining Addictions. And what I basically advise people is, instead of using methadone, use buprenorphine. It's a lot gentler of a replacement therapy, and it's a half agonist, half antagonist. The problem with it is if you have a large habit, it throws you into withdrawal, whereas methadone just solves everything instantly. The problem with methadone is that it's boring, and it can easily kill you too, because it's easy to overdose on it. The great thing about buprenorphine is you can't overdose on it. You go into withdrawal if you take too much of it, so it's a super easy thing to prescribe. And also, buprenorphine isn't as boring as heroin. And so what happens with methadone is that a large proportion, or a significant proportion of the people put on methadone end up getting frustrated by the methadone and then destroy their livers with alcohol to boost and benzodiazepines to boost the effects, the latent effects of the methadone. I mean, other people, of course, solve their problems and become, have successful, working lives, also. So it depends on the person. And also, methadone almost guarantees that it's not worth trying to cheat, whereas if you have the kind of personality that needs a big club that's beating you over the head every day as soon as you try to, get a little bit high, methadone is the right thing for you if in order to not have the disruption of physical addiction. But the problem with it is that it's very, very hard to kick methadone. It's harder to physically detox from methadone than from heroin. So it's a stupid drug, objectively. It's it's basically the only way it works is that it's more addictive than heroin, that's all. And you get habituated. I mean, the first time someone takes methadone, they're so high they can hardly see straight. And then you can stay high for about 3 days of use. And then after that, your tolerance is so high that you don't feel, you feel very, 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 very little. So it's a wretched drug that way. Very, very hard to withdraw.
So how about a round of applause for Professor?